Welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. I'm Matthew Piero, editor, and with me is Dan Walker, social media editor. How's it going, Dan?
It's all right. Just back from the nation's capital.
Are you a bit dizzy? You were riding around in circles on Preston Street?
They were rectangles, Matt. Kindergarten was a long time ago for you.
Well, you know, but geometry wasn't my forte.
A lot of right-hand turns. It was like the NASCAR of bikes. But yeah, it's
an oval. That's an oval, Dan.
Preston Street Crit, what a fun time. Like, they had tons of people out supporting us, even at the 9 o'clock race. There were families up on the hill with the air horns, and their kids were out there cheering.
Nice.
Yeah, no, it was an awesome example for the rest of the country how to do crits.
Oh,
I know, BC Super Week, you've got your stuff out there. But Toronto, we could take a few lessons from our neighbors over in Ottawa.
Oh, there you go. What's on the podcast?
We have Molly Herford.
Yes.
She is going to give us a few lessons on how to crush that KOM.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then it's your favorite segment. It is Full Send, No Send. And we have Adam, producer Adam, here to keep us on the clock. We've been going over the limit, going OT.
Yeah. No, we got to get our game back on track.
Keep things tight.
Keep things tight, focused. I'm excited for that. And finally, in the last part, we have Jeff Webb. I had a chat with him. He runs a Norway-based cycling brand called Fara. That's right, Fara. It's Old Norse.
It's Old Norse?
It's Old Norse.
Yeah, do you know the etymology of Fara?
I believe we get into that, but you said that quite well. I thought you couldn't roll your R's.
Maybe I was just overthinking it.
There you go. You just gotta
get
loose.
I'm actually a little upset at myself I did it right.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, why? Because it sounds a bit Alex Trebek when he pronounces words correctly.
I'm going for pho.
Pho, the Vietnamese soup dish?
Yeah. It's like, I don't like when people say pho.
You'd rather they just say pho.
Exactly.
Well, I'm not. I probably do say Fara, but it's Fara, Old Norse for, I believe, to go. I think we get into that in our conversation, or to travel, to venture.
To venture, like the Vikings?
Exactly, the Vikings. They were just doing a little bit of
Fara.
So you
are pretty much a Viking on this bike.
There you go, Viking biking.
Viking, oh.
But I talk with Jeff about the brand and his approach to a cycling brand. And we'll get into that. But first, we talk about riding uphill. Summer means climbing. July brings the pros to the Tour de France. During that month, they'll face La Planche des Belles Filles, Col de Tourmalet, Col d'Izoard, and Col de Galibier. Likely, your fitness is pretty good at this time of year, and you'll be tempted to take on some inclines. Maybe you'll be heading to Sea Otter, Canada soon for one of the festival's two climbing competitions, the Grind Uphill Challenge and the Hill Climbing Championships. Whatever your target, contributor Molly Herford has some tips for riding well when the road or trail gets steep. Molly Herford, we're going to talk about how to nail a KOM on dirt and road, but first I thought I'd ask, how do you feel about climbing?
Oh, I have the most mixed feelings ever about climbing. If I'm out by myself, climbing is pretty much one of my favorite things, and I will actively go try to find hills to climb. If I'm in a race, I will be cursing my life, questioning my choices, wondering if I can, you know, stick a nail in my tire or something like that during climbs in road racing.
I'm trying to suppress a laugh as you're telling me this. It's interesting your conflicted feelings, but I think those I think you're not the only one who feels like that, because sometimes when you're alone and you just nail the climb, you wish you had an audience and spectators. But then there are times when, you know, there's too much of the world around you when you are struggling uphill.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I'll admit, I have the best possible place to be doing my own solo hill climbing training, because I live up in Collingwood, so we're right on the Niagara Escarpment. So we have, you know, a dozen different amazing climbs pretty much in our backyard that, you know, all crest with a beautiful view of the Georgian Bay. So there's kind of no way to feel bad on them. other than, you know, the fact that your heart rate is skyrocketed and your legs are burning. But outside of that, it feels fantastic.
I want to touch on your local climbs in a bit, but first, which do you like climbing better, dirt climbs or road climbs?
You know, I have to say road climbs. I mean, I love a good short technical climb on the dirt, but something about just, you know, give me a 20, 25 mile road climb and I am the happiest person in the world to just chug away up that.
Nice. So how do you practice road climbs? And you know, for someone looking for advice, what would you tell them about getting better on going uphill on roads?
You know, it's funny, you get asked this all the time, and it seems like the most obvious thing tends to get missed a little bit, which is just, you gotta get out and climb. You know, unfortunately, in Ontario in particular, we have a lot of very flat areas, so sometimes it's not that easy to get out and climb, but you know what? At some point, the only way to get better at climbing is gonna be to get out and do the climbing.
It's true, and it's with jealousy. I look at our friends in Vancouver and their local climbs, and... Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you're, cursed is a strong word, but elevation challenged, it can be a struggle.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just talking to Swain Tuft on the phone for another interview the other day, which just makes me the luckiest person in the world that I get to say that. He lives in Andorra. He's at 2,400 feet sea level, and that's where his house is. So every day to start his ride, he has to go down that. And then to finish his ride, he has to climb like 800 meters to get up to it. So he's got the most built-in hill climbing out of anyone that I know, and I'm so jealous.
Yeah, definitely. That's envy-inducing. So the key is to practice. And I guess ideally, if you have, you know, a 12-kilometer climb, you ride a 12-kilometer climb. But what can you do without a 12-kilometer climb in your backyard?
You know, you find what you have and you figure out how to use that. You know, it's not going to always be ideal. It's not like most of us have our race course in our backyard. So, you know, that might mean you have to do repeats of the 2-minute hill if you know that you're going to be doing a race that has, you know, a massive 10-mile climb in it. You know, you might have to just, when you get to the top of the hill, keep going on your interval and, you know, just make that work and grind it out. It's never going to be a perfect situation. There's a reason that, you know, someone who happens to be an amazing climber for like, you know, a 5-mile effort probably happens to have a 5-mile hill climb near him. And he probably isn't as good at a 10-mile or 20-mile hill.
There's a reason that riders from Colombia tend to be good climbers.
Exactly.
Tell me about positioning on the bike during a climb.
Yeah, so a couple things. I mean, the first is a lot of people think that standing is only a thing that you should do at the very end of the climb, you know, to sprint to the finish, or only the greatest hill climbers in the world are the ones who stand up. But really, everyone can be moving around on the bike when they're climbing instead of just kind of sitting down very hard on the saddle and just, you know, kind of getting in there for the duration of the climb and never shifting around. You can really do a lot if you're, you know, getting up and standing for a couple of pedal strokes and, you know, working out your legs that way and, you know, moving around on the saddle, you know, move a little farther forward, move a little farther backward. Feel free to shift around, especially like the longer the climb gets, the less you should be in one position. And then, I mean, the other thing with positioning is you really want to keep your upper body relaxed. I know so many people who get super tense in their upper back and their arms when they're climbing. And I mean, you know, on a short, hard climb, sure, your whole body is going to be tense. But when you're on a sustained climb, think about how much energy you're expending on keeping your back super tight and your muscles super tight. You could be really using that in your legs. So trying to keep your upper body relaxed while your lower body is doing all the work for you and trying to activate all your muscles. The amount of cyclists who don't use their glutes, it's a pretty high percentage. So if you can even get in the gym and learn what it feels like to actually get your glutes firing, that's going to make you such a strong climber instead of just focusing on, you know, making your quads and your calves do all the work.
Breathing is another issue or feature while you're struggling up a hill. What should we keep in mind with regard to our breath?
Yeah, the big thing to keep in mind is that hills are freaking hard. You know, you're gonna be breathing hard. Anyone who comes by you on a climb, everybody knows this guy, the guy that's gonna pedal up to you on a climb and make an effort to make a conversation with you just to kind of show off that he's not breathing hard. I guarantee you the second you guys stop talking, he's turning around and like gasping for air. He's really just trying to psychologically mess with you a little bit. Everybody breathes hard on climbs, so don't stress if you start breathing a little heavier and your heart rate starts going up a little bit. That's normal. Hills are going to be hard. No matter how good you are at climbing them, they're still going to be hard. And I think we have this expectation that, you know, once we've started riding and once, you know, we're pretty decent cyclists, that hills are going to magically become these easy things that we can effortlessly, or at least with less effort, just kind of pedal up casually. But there's always going to be a hill that's going to test the limits of your abilities. So don't stress if you're finding it difficult. It is difficult.
Is there any difference between climbing on dirt, dirtier roads or even trail, and paved sections?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with dirt, traction is going to be everything. So unfortunately, you know, on dirt, you have to be a little bit more careful about how you're maneuvering and how you're standing up. Sometimes when you stand, I'm sure a lot of people have had this happen. If you stand up on a dirt climb, sometimes your rear wheel is going to start spinning out and you're going to lose traction. You're going to have to put a foot down. You're going to be running. No one likes that, let's be honest. But it's more inclined to happen. So you really have to focus on keeping your weight a lot more balanced. And I think, you know what, I'm going to say in defense of running, the other thing that we tend to overlook in climbing on the dirt is, you know what, sometimes we're actually going to be faster if we just get off and run instead of doing that thing where you put a foot down and then you're trying to get started again and, you know, you do like the one pedal stroke, half run, half hop, half pedal kind of thing, where you're not really going any faster and you're much better off just doing a straight dismount, running up the hill, using your top tube instead of holding on to both handlebars, running up the hill and then remounting quickly at the top. So I think just putting it out there, it's okay to run up the hill if you stall out.
That is a good point. Think your sort of cyclocross math. If the speed at which you're going up this hill is slower than running or walking, you know, maybe it's time to get off the bike. Now, we're a few weeks out from the Hill Climbing Championships, which are being held in your neighborhood at Sea Otter Canada. Is there any inside information that you can give us, since these are your local climbs, as on to maybe crushing these bits of elevation?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's both an off-road and an on-road one. Technically, the Hill Climb Championships is on Pretty River on the road, and then there's also an off-road one that's up the grind at Blue Mountain. For Pretty River, the best tip I can give you is, when you see a corner coming up and it looks like it's the end of the climb, it absolutely is not. So do not sprint at that corner, because you are going to come around it and you are not going to be happy that you did that. Wait until you see, you know, I'm not sure exactly how they're going to mark the course, but wait until you see something that says the finish is just up there, or, you know exactly where you are on your GPS, to really start going for that final effort, because it's so tricky in there, because it's very tree lined and you can't really see the top. So just be aware, it's going to be terrible. You're going to think you're almost done. You're not going to be almost done, but you're going to make it. And it's a beautiful, beautiful climb. And for the grind, kind of almost what I was just saying about the dirt, there's a lot of leveled out places and there's a lot of little steep punchy bits. And if you have to get off and run, know that you're going to find a place to remount pretty quickly. And I think you're much better off getting off and running for all you're worth and jumping back on as soon as it flattens out, than trying to keep regaining traction and restarting if you stall out.
Molly, you are like better than a DS or a Grand Tour road book. That's some key information for anyone taking on those climbs.
Yes, you'll notice I'm not signed up though.
All right. Well, then maybe we'll see you on the side of the road yelling LA, LA, or up, up, up.
Yeah, maybe I'll go like halfway up Pretty River and just keep warning people that they're not there yet.
Nice. Well, Molly, thank you very much for all these tips.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Molly Herford is the author of Shred Girls, a work of young adult fiction featuring a girl named Lindsay who discovers how rad riding bikes can be.
All right, 5 minutes on the clock starting now.
All right, Matthew, you've been doing a couple science experiments out in the woods, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I have a bike, an MEC bike, and I also have 650B wheels and 700C wheels. So I did, it was very scientific. I measured the diameter of both of these. Do you know what the difference is? The 700C had 30C tires and the 650 had 42. The actual diameter of both of them, the difference in diameter was 11 millimeters. Anyway, very scientific measurements. I did a test loop, which had me on very different surfaces. And you can find my conclusions in an upcoming issue of Canadian Cycling Magazine. But it really got us all talking here at the office. It's like, do we need 650B on our burly gravel bikes?
Yeah, I mean, this is that whole like, if it's getting so rowdy, why am I still on a drop bar bike kind of conversation? I mean, my take is, yeah, it can help give you a lot of confidence, but if it's not on a bike that has suitable gearing, then you're just stuck with big, slow tires on a bike that's most of the time going to be on the road.
Yeah. I think the gains are... they're not super huge. I did notice for sure on my experiment, like less traction with the skinnier tires, but it didn't really affect where I could go. Where it has affected where I could go, where 650B was super important for me, was on skidoo trails in the woods. But how many, I'm only on skidoo trails in the woods maybe once or twice a year.
And it's not like you can't go on those trails with 700C wheels either. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, I guess it gives you that added level of confidence.
Confidence and just, no, there's actually more traction. It was more forgiving if I'd mess up. I remember in one spot, if I had done that on 700Cs, my foot would have gone down and I'd be walking. So, but then I was on highway for the next 2 hours. And okay, here's another thing. The engine that is your legs still is a bigger factor, I think, because I was on a climb with the 650Bs, and I know Strava, whatever, KOMs are suspect. But
you
was,
got a PB, right?
No, second fastest on a certain climb. So that's the GAMs, man, not the wheels. So full send, no send on 650B?
I think I'm going no send, unless you're going adventure gearing. Like, that's the only... Like, if you have that kind of gearing set up on the bike, then I think it works. But if you have like traditional road gearing, I'm not into it.
I'm going to say full send if you need the confidence, maybe don't ride gravel as often. And if it helps you and you have more fun on it, do it. If you don't need it, meh, there you go. Okay, next topic.
All right, Mike Woods. He has announced that he's going to the tour this year, or EF Education First has announced that he's probably going to the tour.
We have it on good... we suspect quite confidently that he's going to the tour this year. Yes, let's go with that. Do we want him, as fans, to go for stages or to go for a good GC classification?
I'm saying stages all the way. I want Woodsy putting up Ws.
Totally victory V's across the line.
Like, get the dubs, get those wins on the parkour, or on the Palmares, sorry. And like, if he goes for the GC, my thing is he's just going to be a la Zabeldia, maybe going for eighth place.
If we look at the tea leaves, that is the Dauphiné. So he rode into six after stage two, but then after the time trial, he fell, I think, roughly nine places. He went from 7th to 16th after the individual time trial on stage four. And his teammates are likely to be TJ Van Garderen and Rigoberto Urán. Van Garderen did quite well with his second at the Dauphiné, but you know what happened the last time he was second at the Dauphiné?
I don't, but...
He went to the Tour and DNF.
Okay.
So anyway, that's my roundabout way of actually agreeing with you. I think for Woods, his skill is more suited to maybe the stages, and yep. he could for sure support his guys. And maybe, though, he could be a danger at the beginning, you know, getting into the top 10, and then his moves might get marked. If that might actually hinder him, but then it would help his teammates.
Yeah, that's it. It's if he's, you know, top 15, somewhere like that, he can do a lot to support TJ, support maybe Rigoberto if he's there. Mm-hmm. But...
I think that counts as us being done. Mm. I mean, we covered the bases, but there's your alarm. There's your full send.
No, so much more fun when Adam's not here.
I don't know. This keeps us honest. Earlier this month, Jeff Webb was looking around the blacksmith shop in Toronto. Some frames from his company, Farah Cycling, hung on the walls. His own bike was getting worked on by one of blacksmith's mechanics, so it would be ready for a ride leaving from the shop that evening. Webb and his partners started the Oslo, Norway-based Farah Cycling about 4 years ago. Today, Tor Hushov is one of the company's owners. Webb, as you might have guessed from his last name, is not Norwegian. He's originally from Huntsville, Ontario. He started racing bikes as a kid. He competed in North America in the same events as George Hincapie, Jonas Carney, Eric Wahlberg, and even Lance Armstrong. Later, he got a contract to ride with Castorama Development Team in France, where he was based for 3 years. When he left competitive road racing, he still stayed with cycling, in a way. He entered the European sporting goods and cycling industry. Webb and I found a quiet spot in the fitting room at Blacksmith to discuss Farah Cycling. But before I started asking about the company, I wanted to know about a recent ride he had done. He likes taking his Farah Cycling road bike on what he calls fast bike packing or light touring trips.
Yeah, so actually 2 weeks ago, I set off on a little weekend journey where I basically left Oslo on Friday morning. It's the national day in Oslo, the 17th of May. So everyone was out with all their national garb on, and there was parades and all kinds of stuff going. And I went right through the center of Oslo where they do the big parade and rode from just sort of a celebration of... you know, Oslo and Norway's independence. I rode from Oslo to Stockholm. It's 610 kilometers, I think, all told.
And you did that on a whim, almost.
Yeah, so basically, I'd had the idea for a long time. I'd like to do it, and I was checking the weather forecast and stuff and didn't really have any plans for the weekend, so I just, the day before, pretty much decided I wanted to go. And I've done quite a few bikepacking trips of that, of that kind of nature, so it doesn't take me long to pack my stuff and get ready to go.
So you did the trip on a Farah bike, which is your company, you're the CEO. Tell me how that bike and that trip and Farah, the company, all kind of intersect.
Yeah, so we look at cycling, or at least if you kind of take the road side of cycling, as opposed to the mountain bike side, as a 180 degree spectrum, where over on the left you have maybe 15 to 20 degrees of racing, you know, pro racing, elite level racing, that kind of stuff. And that sort of fade into more of just normal road riding and that kind of stuff. And then the rest of the 160 degrees is everything from gravel to adventure, bike packing, touring. And I think that's really the aspect of cycling that we would like to focus on, and we will focus on going forward. So the bikes we make and the types of riding that we're inspired by is more the outside of the aspect of the racing.
Now, what does the name Farah mean? I think I need to roll my R. It's Farah.
Yeah, you did that really well, actually. Well done. Yeah, so Farah is Basically, the word fara, it's a verb, it's Old Norse, and it comes from the Viking times when they used to use the verb as a description for a trip, an adventure, or a journey when they would set off to sea and to discover new lands or new parts of the world. So it's basically, yeah, it comes from the Old Norse, to adventure or to travel.
So what kicked off your adventure in being CEO of a bike company? What was the moment where you decided, you and your partners said, okay, we need to start making Fara bikes?
So we started about 4 years ago, I should say. I've been working in the sports industry for almost all of my adult life, and I saw some opportunities and saw some things that we thought could be done better or done differently. And I have a good friend back in Oslo who runs one of the biggest design firms in all Scandinavia. And so I talked, and he's also a cycling nut. And I have also a really good friend who's a photographer, and super talented photographer. And we just sort of got together as a bit of a group and hashed out some ideas about how we could do this differently, and just try to approach the whole cycling thing from a little different angle.
I'm going to name some companies, and these aren't totally random, but because I know these companies connect in with your thinking about Fara bikes. And maybe you can connect the company to your company. So company one, Rafa.
Yeah, so when we started 4 years ago, 2015, 2016, was really like when Rafa was kind of hitting its peak or towards its peak. And I used Rafa as kind of a general description of a style of, a cyclist or rider lifestyle that's built around cycling. And we basically saw that the apparel industry had really done a good job of following or maybe creating these trends about more fashion-driven cycling inspiration, but the hard goods side of the industry were not really on the ball. Like, they were really still just following the doing what they'd always been doing, and so we wanted to really address this new movement towards fashion driven cycling, basically, and try to mix performance with fashion and make a product that we would like to ride, and we would be kind of be proud of, or be stoked to go in the garage and see that bike looking there that looked really nice and rode really well, and that was clean, and that really matched the rest of the way we would like to dress and everything else. So we felt there was a real opening there to do something that both inspired us, and that was sometimes I've been living outside of Canada for so long that I can't always find the right words for everything, but just that was more fitting with the new style of riders. So, and that fits in really well again with the whole adventure cycling. This is this genre that's coming up that I don't even really know what to call it, but it's kind of a mix between not really racing but training, and people who just like to ride, and the touring thing, and now it's like fast touring or light backpacking, or I don't even know what you call it anymore, but the ride that I did from Oslo to Stockholm, I basically had 3 kilos of luggage on, or 3 kilos of baggage, whatever you want to call it, on a standard road disc bike. There was, with 28 millimeter tires and carbon wheels and electric gearing and everything else, and just, there's so little extra that you need, and you can go away for a weekend or whatever. And so I to me, this whole new trend of riding really far, really slow, is kind of, I think it's really exciting, and I think it's a really interesting new trend, and I think it's going to be really popular going forward for sure.
Next company, Tesla.
Yeah, so we really wanted to look outside again. Like we wanted, it's not that we wanted to do something different just to do it different, but we you know, our ideas, we were kind of inspired by brands and companies that are not necessarily inside the cycling industry or the sporting goods industry for that matter. And Tesla was one of them. And just the buying process, if you look at how you purchase a Tesla, I mean, they're definitely a company that's forward thinking, and they're looking to the future. And that's why our logo is the road ahead. It's, you know, because that's, we're building this company for, you know, what's going to be happening in the sporting goods industry in the next 10 years, not the last 40 years. And when you look at the buying process for a Tesla, it's a little bit similar to how we do things. You start with a model, and then you build the, configure the model, or the bike, I should say, on top of the frame of the model itself. So we have, right now we have three, soon to be four silos in our product range. So it's the road bike with rim brakes, there's the road disc bike, there's the gravel bike, and soon to be a TT bike, and basically just start with the frame and then build the configuration on that. And you end up with a bike that's unique. It's built exactly to your specifications, and every one of our bikes is a custom build, so that's kind of unique. And that's done right on our website. yeah, I should also put a little disclaimer in, because we're not actually doing that for Canada. So in Canada, we're working with Blacksmith and some other dealers.
Final company, IKEA.
Yeah, I think. I'm not sure if we've really been that, like, taken that much directly from IKEA, but it's a general Scandinavian, the Scandinavian mindset is to keep things simple, and it's about, like, doing things in a simple way, and things that are smart and things that work, and there's not a lot of marketing, you know, BS that's built around the products or the brand. It's about being transparent and being effective and efficient, and making simple things that work really well, and that also being able to offer them at a competitive price. And you know, I think IKEA is an example of people who do that really well, obviously. And there's lots of other examples as well. And you know, Scandinavia is kind of known for sensible products that work really well and well designed and look good. And that's sort of where also we would like our brand to fit into that type of category.
You're in Canada visiting family, but your bikes are coming to Canada, or are they in Canada right now? And tell us about how that, you kind of mentioned earlier how it's a bit of a different model in Europe and in North America and Canada. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so we're based out of Oslo, Norway, and the EU, which is the European Union, is a market that we deal with directly, doing consumer direct online, and so we have a one-on-one connection or contact with all of our customers, and then in both Canada and Asia, we have use a little different model that we use local partners, because basically, at just a distance, and it's also a little bit easier to, and we offer a better service to the customers as well. So in Asia, we basically have like a partner in like Seoul and Hong Kong, Taipei, and different the cities, the major cities. And in Canada, we have Blacksmith here in where we're sitting today, here in Toronto, and also Eurosports in Ottawa, and could see that maybe expanding by one or two dealers within the next couple of years, but we're not in any hurry to do any expansion or anything. And the basically the criteria to be a dealer that we want to work with is someone who can offer the same service that we do on our website or we do at home, but they do it, you know, basically locally. So it's a bike shop that's building bikes from a frame up and has that one-on-one connection to their buyers. And obviously, you know, Blacksmith is a good example of people that do that and spend a lot of time with each customer and make sure that the customer has a product that they're completely, you know, that fits them and suits them. So, and that's what we're all about as well.
Your bikes have been ridden in some pretty big ways. We just mentioned your Oslo to Stockholm. You also did Oslo to Naples, I think. And recently you did Dirty Kanza. Is there anywhere else you'd like to see a Fara bike taken?
Yeah, I mean, we have way more things than that, the stuff that I haven't done myself. So we had a guy rode the Japanese Odyssey on one of our road bikes, basically, 2 years ago. And the same guy also rode across the States with a Search and State group. And we had a guy who rode, actually he did the Everest on the little stretch of road that is at the Everest base camp. So he's Everested on Everest on one of our bikes, which is pretty crazy. I think it took him 48 hours or something like that to it's like 6,000 meters of elevation, so it's pretty crazy. So yeah, we've got bikes all over the world doing some pretty fun things. So it's always fun to see. And I don't want to like scoop some of your questions maybe, but we built this brand around using more ambassadors as opposed to a traditional sponsorship type of model. So these types of people that provide us with the stories and the content that our people that follow us like to see and that are interested in. So I mean, some of the stuff I do myself, but there's also we have a lot of other people who are doing some really cool things. And we also work with Tor Husovd, who is a 2010 world champion pro men, and he's obviously a legend in Norway, and he's one of our owners actually, and now he's in our ownership group. And another ex who actually just recently retired, Olympic and multiple World Cup world champion skier, is Axel Lund Svindal, his name is. And he's a legend in the alpine skiing world, and he's also an avid cyclist. So he's another guy who we work pretty closely with.
And what's next for Fara Bikes?
Yeah, so I would like to see us, or we would like to continue to explore this adventure, bikepacking, the scene, and see how we can grow that. Really focus the brand on that section, and also the fact that we have a really unique scene in Oslo, in that it's a city, it's a capital city, it's a world-renowned city, but it's also it's quite small city, if you compare it to Toronto or anything like that, and the city is surrounded by like thousands of acres of wilderness forest that's protected. And through that forest is like a spider web network of gravel roads. So within 15 minutes of downtown, you can be out in the forest riding gravel. So the gravel scene there is obviously huge, and it's growing very rapidly. And in that forest, that's called Nordmarka, it's the roads go from, like gravel highways, with super nice gravel, like really smooth and everything, to smaller double tracks, to single track, rutty, rocky. So there's really like a really wide variety of terrain in there. I mean, some of the stuff you could ride a road bike on without a problem. And what guys starting to do now is they will ride through Nordmarka out the other side and ride home on asphalt. So this sort of combining, it's like, the one bike that does everything, combining the gravel and this type of wilderness area with asphalt and small country roads. So that's something that we're looking to we've already started basically on some frame designs that will be specifically geared towards that type of riding, and that's something we're really, really looking forward to.
I also look forward to maybe checking out those bikes someday. Jeff, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Jeff Webb is the CEO of Fara Cycling, an Oslo, Norway-based cycling brand. He's originally from Huntsville, Ontario. And that's the episode. It's put together by me, Matthew Piaro, and Dan Walker, with help from Terry McCall and Philippe Tremblay. It's produced by Adam Killick. He also composed the music. Also, thanks to Ontario Creates for its support. Dan, if people want more Canadian cycling, where can they go?
If they want more Canadian cycling coverage, you should probably check out cyclingmagazine.ca.
Mm-hmm.
There, you can check out all our social channels. You can see articles about Woodsy. You can see articles about our 650B, 700C, what should you ride?
Oh, yeah.
And next thing they should do, rate, subscribe, review.
Oh,
but
yes.
Only if it's 5 stars and only if...
they say something nice.
There you go.
Please do. That helps us a lot. If you want to send us an email, maybe you have a full send, no send idea. Maybe you have a question for Coach Peter Glassford on his semi-regular column, Ask a Coach. Send that email to podcast@cyclingmagazine.ca. And oh, please tell people about the podcast. Who should our listeners tell to spread the word?
Well, what celestial event is coming up next week?
Well, actually, this is probably landing in the midst of that celestial event known as Solstice.
Yep.
Sounds so cosmic, dude. You're going to be dancing around a maypole or something? Or is that earlier in the season?
I think it's only around May.
I don't know my Wiccan things.
Anyways, it is often the time of year when we have the 24-hour summer solstice mountain bike rides.
Yes.
So, when you're sitting around the campfire with your team, they're going to ask, hey, what are you listening to get psyched for your next lap? What are you going to tell them?
Oh, Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast.
Boom.
Download it and talk to you later.